But we grab the pepper spray and we're ready to burst out of the tent. And because this car is like coming just, and it feels like it must only be a couple of feet outside the door, and the lights are still just blazing on us, you know. And we're like, oh my God, like we're in the tent, bolt upright, just ready for action. And then suddenly we hear this voice. She's like, hello, sorry, we baked you some cookies.
Episode 304. Scott and Joe Roxy decided to get acquainted with their new home in the United States by bicycling across it. You're listening to the Adventure Sports Podcast, brought to you by 180 Tech. We talk with adventurers from around the globe to bring you the inspiration and motivation you need to get started in the outdoors or to keep you moving if you're already there. Now here's your host, Kurt Linville.
Hello again. This is Kurt. Thank you so much for listening to the Adventure Sports Podcast. Man, I have a lovely couple on the line today from Australia. They moved to the United States, lived here for 5 years before returning to Australia just recently. They moved here in 2012, and they had a wonderful way of sorting out where they wanted to live here. They biked all over the United States to try to select their favorite place. And then they found the place that they would call home, had an amazing adventure, and now back in Australia. Welcome to the program, Scott Pierce and Joe Roxy Vegan Lloyd.
Hi, Kurt.
Hey, Kurt. How you doing?
So, Scott and Joe Roxy.
Yes.
We were just talking about hyphenated names. And yes. By the time I say Scott Pierce, Joe Roxy Vegan Lloyd, we've got a lot going on there.
I've got a double hyphenate name, yeah.
That's awesome.
Hippie parents are to blame, not me being a wanker or anything.
That's great. So you are in Australia right now in the middle of a big rainstorm.
Yes, and it's pouring, and my chicken shed's about to fall over. But we've got Airbnb as we rent out our house on Airbnb. And we're about to go camping in the snow.
Oh, my.
We have to have everything perfect before the Airbnbs come. So I'm running around frantically trying to make sure it's not too muddy.
Wow. So it's almost springtime in Northern Australia.
It's starting to get that way. And we're in the mid-north coast. So we are in a little place called Smith's Lake, which is about 3 hours north of the Sydney Harbour Bridge. If that's your point of reference. So where it starts to become pretty dense, pretty tropical. We're actually in a littoral rainforest here.
Which does sound like clitoral.
We do get a lot of rain. A lot of rain, a lot of wind, a lot of big storms.
Yeah.
Wow. So I don't use the bridge. I use the Opera House for my frame of reference, if that's okay.
Well, the Opera House is under the bridge.
Yeah, so it's about 3 hours and 5 minutes.
Or we could use the harbor, right? No, that's awesome.
Yeah.
That's awesome. Yeah. So we were just exchanging notes before I press record about having chickens. And I shared that we recently, last spring, lost all of our chickens to a bobcat family. And then you shared something interesting about yours.
We have a diamond python that Scott's mother's called Melissa. I don't like that name, but it's stuck. And she's about over 3 meters long.
Wow.
And then she tries to get into the shed, more so in when it was warmer.
Yeah.
But she doesn't seem to be interested in the chickens. I feel like she's smart enough to know that if she leaves the chickens, the eggs will be more plentiful. So she tries to eat the chickens, but the only way we can get rid of her is spraying her with a hose.
Which is a very Australian thing to do. Yeah. I feel like that's a really...
I feel like if there's ever a problem, just spray it with a hose.
Yeah, it's very Australian. It's a very Australian image, us out there just getting...
Although wasting water isn't very Australian.
Does that work on the crocodiles too?
Luckily, we don't. We have everything but crocodiles here, which I'm thankful for.
Yeah,
you got to go a little bit.
You have to go much further north.
Yeah, they're a bit more of our fair weather friends.
Mm.
Well, excuse my ignorance, but is the python indigenous?
It is.
Yes.
That one is particularly, especially to this area,
and it's very important to the Worimi people, which are the original custodians of the land.
Yeah.
So the Worimi people who are originally here find it's almost totemic, the diamond python.
So
it's quite good luck that we have it. And it keeps away all the rats and mice and all those pesky things.
And the diamond pythons are essentially harmless. They move very slowly. I mean, they're almost tame enough that you can just pick them up in the wild. I mean, I'm not recommending that anyone do that, nor do I do it myself. I have touched the snake, but I don't try and pick it up or anything like that, but they move very slowly and they tend to, a lot of people around here will have them living in their roofs, whether they know it or not. But you know, as soon as they deplete whatever's living up there in terms of mice, we get a lot of bats and things like that. As soon as they deplete the food source, they'll move on. But, luckily for the snakes here, as far as we know, our one's been living in our roof for over a decade. The previous owners of the house told us about it. So she's been here for quite a long time and grown to a fairly large size.
She is absolutely beautiful, I have to say. She's got this bright, bright yellow stomach and she's divine. But other people don't find it that way
It's a little bit of a concern given that our house is an Airbnb property.
Well, okay, we got to get a little bit more detail then. You know, aren't pythons constrictors?
Yes.
So totally. Did you ever wake up in the night feeling a little bit extra constricted?
Well, you know, that's just how you stay warm in the winter. No, and hopefully that never comes to that. It never comes to that. But, I mean, they've got enough food up in the roof that there's no reason for them to come down. I mean, as we said, they sit in the chicken shed and don't even look at the chickens as food.
Wow.
Just because of the size of the chicken. They could definitely take down a small dog. It'd have to be a pretty small dog.
It'd have to be like a chihuahua.
Yeah.
Okay.
But they don't, as I said, they don't move very fast and, fingers crossed.
Well, good. You know, I love to share your locale and the setting of where you're talking to us. That just sounds fascinating. What time is it in Australia? I know it's tomorrow, but what time is it?
It is 8:48 a.m. on the 25th of August.
8:48. So I am at 4:48. And
on the 20th.
Yeah.
So we are in the future. So if you want to know what happens tomorrow, ask an Australian.
I love it. That's great. Yeah. Fantastic. Well, you know, the reason that we started to have you on was to talk about your amazing American bike adventure, but I'm tempted just to talk about Australia.
Is this the first time you've had an Australian on the show?
No, it's not. No, we've had Australians before, and but they were from Southern Australia. We've talked to a few people from Perth and areas around there. So I think you might be the first ones from north of Sydney.
Okay. Great. Right on. Yeah. I mean, Australians are a pretty intrepid bunch. So I would be surprised if you hadn't had someone on the show before, that's for sure.
Yeah. No, and I love it. I think Australia, you know, the reputation that it has among people who have been there is that you are some of the most friendly people on the planet. People love Australia because of the people.
Yeah, I mean, it is. We do very much benefit from a fantastic reputation abroad, especially traveling as an Australian. I think that's one of the reasons why we do it so much, is because you just kind of open your mouth and everybody sort of wants to talk to you. So it's definitely very advantageous for us, our reputation.
Definitely
abroad.
In America, I think I wouldn't have gotten the job that I did get if I was an Australian. I think if it was. Americans find us particularly charming for some reason. Yeah. So I felt very welcome in America.
Crocodile Dundee. I mean, it's got to be that.
You know, I've got a story.
We got a lot of, like, yes. Yeah,
go ahead.
I'm sorry. No, go ahead, Joe Roxy. What were you going to say?
Oh, I was just going to say we got out of a lot of driving fines and drinking on the street fines by just, like, amping up the Australian accent in America and just being, oh, sorry, mate.
Oh, geez.
Didn't know.
Bloody hell, eh? Didn't know you weren't allowed to drink on the beach.
So that is right in alignment with the story. But this story was not about an Australian. It was about a British fellow that I was – we attended – some business meetings in Las Vegas and had some time. So we went to go see the Hoover Dam. And when we got to the security roadblock where they checked to make sure that any cars headed in that direction aren't going to cause any problems, he veered off the road into a parking lot like he was trying to go around the roadblock. And he did it because he had to use the restroom. But anyway, here comes Homeland Security, lights flashing, you know. And I'm like, oh, no. And he goes, oh, don't worry, I'll just use my accent. And sure as the world, he jumps out and flashes his, in this case, British accent. And they were just mm-hmm. like, oh, yeah, no problem. I thought, wow, how does that work?
It works like a charm.
Yeah, it really does. I mean, we shouldn't really probably be promoting this in the wider world.
Yeah, keep it on the down low.
Yeah, that the way around Homeland Security is to use a fake Australian or British accent. but it certainly does get you out of a lot of situations.
Well, that's great. That's fantastic. So why did you guys decide to come to the U.S.?
So we'd been living in London for, Scott had been there for 6 years, I'd been there for two and a bit, and we actually met in London, and then my visa ran out, mm-hmm. and Scott wanted to go back to school in Australia, so we moved back to Australia, and I was not ready for it, and so I started to hatch plans about what I could do, because I knew I didn't want to be in Australia for too long at that point, and ended up thinking America would be a good choice.
I think at some point we'd actually said it, like we were just going to move to America and it wouldn't be that difficult type thing. But you know, and then it turns out it is actually quite difficult to move mm-hmm. and live in the US, you know, with the visa situation and all that. But we were lucky enough, we're DV1 recipients, which is an online lottery where you can win American permanent residency.
Like green card lottery.
Wow. The green card lottery. And we actually won we won our green card through the green card lottery. But yeah, so we were very, it was funny because we sort of left England being like, yeah, we'll just move to America. It'll be easy.
And then it all sort of worked out. Yeah.
It must have been your accent.
Yeah, it's
only certain countries that are eligible.
Yeah.
And Australia is one of them, but each country has roughly the same allotment. And Australia is so small, really, that a lot of people per capita end up being able to get it when they apply, because not that many people apply.
Ah, okay. Well, that's cool. That's really cool. So forgive my ignorance again, is Australia still a British Commonwealth?
Yeah, yes. We are. But we're currently talking a lot about that internally here, about whether we become a republic. It seems
lots of people want to wait for Queen Elizabeth to die out of respect.
Out of respect.
It is.
Yeah.
It's a funny old thing.
We do have a strange relationship with our mother country still. And being such a small, relatively unpopulated outpost in the middle of nowhere, I think we do tend to grasp more strongly onto these ties that you know. Mm-hmm. That bind us to our history and to allies should things go wrong.
Yeah.
Right. Well, I would imagine that would make it a lot easier for you to, say, live in Canada or like you were in London.
Oh, precisely. Yeah. Yeah. You go to any ski slope in Canada and I guarantee you that anyone who's working behind a counter will have an Australian accent.
Mm. There you go.
Whether it be a bar or where you're hiring your ski equipment from, you're going to find a lot of Australians. Banff and Whistler seems to be the big two.
Mm. Oh, yeah, yeah. So you hatched this plan to come to the U.S. and didn't do a lot of planning, but what did you plan for and how did you get here?
We knew that we had friends in Philadelphia and that was a good enough place to start. I mean, somewhere to land and stay for a couple of weeks where you get your bearings is always a good thing. But other than that, we really didn't have a lot until we hatched a plan at some point to cycle across America. We were talking about this last night, and I don't remember how really we came to that decision. Like we don't really, at that point, we didn't know anyone that was a touring cyclist. Australia, it didn't feel like something that a lot of people were doing. A lot of people that do touring cycling here in Australia, riding up the East Coast, but it's sort of a Cairns through to Sydney and New South Wales thing. And we were down in Victoria where it's another state, it's a long ways away. So we'd really never even seen a touring cyclist before.
Well, no, because I had it in my mind because my father always did it.
Oh, that's true.
So I think it might have been, last night when we were talking about it, I was thinking about how it came to be. And I do remember saying at one point, wouldn't it be great if you could just eat everything and not care? When we moved to America, you know, just like guilt-free calories.
Yeah.
And but my father always used to tour around the world because he was a ophthalmologist, and he used to go to conferences. And at the conferences, there was a crew that went for a bike tour at whatever country they were in. So he did China, he did France, lots and lots of places. Everywhere where they stopped for a conference, this group of people would go on a tour together. So I think I was aware of touring that way. Mm-hmm. But I didn't even learn how to ride a bike till I was 21. So it wasn't like top of mind for me.
No.
Until you were 21. So as in you didn't know how to balance a bike, or you just really hadn't spent time on one?
Didn't know how to balance one,
Wow.
Yeah, I think I was a big disappointment to my dad when I was little because I was, like, just not interested. So I wasn't even – it wasn't top of mind ever. It's not like I had a big kind of driving passion for it. But Scott was super into cycling.
Yeah.
And loved doing – you'd done a few tours across the UK.
When I was in the UK, I rode across the UK a couple of times, and which sounds far more intrepid than it is, because you can ride across the UK in 3 days. So it's not that big deal. But that was all mountain bike, sort of an early form of bike packing where you just put a backpack on your back, I suppose.
Right.
I'd done that sort of stuff. And I guess it all just, I think at one stage we were like, oh, let's go driving. You know, we're going to the United States. Let's go drive around it and see all that stuff. And I think at that point we were like, okay, sitting in a car all day and then eating truck stop food's not going to be that great for us. So maybe if we can incorporate, you know, 8 hours of exercise into every day, we'll really earn our, huevos rancheros every day.
You know, with the average American diet, I think 8 hours of exercise might be about right.
And that's given the worldwide reputation of the United States, that's what we were kind of banking on, like really upping our calorie intake into like sort of, you know, 6,000-7,000 calories a day. So, I mean, we really needed to match that with an appropriate amount of exercise.
Well, some chicken fried steak with French fries, maybe, you know, throw in a big slice of pie and then a couple of beers on top of that.
Oh, too much.
Yeah, you can get 2,000 or 3,000 calories out of a meal.
Yeah,
One milkshake. Sometimes when it would be really hot when we were cycling and you just needed energy and
milkshakes.
Like in Kansas. There's nothing for miles. So you're like, oh, just get a milkshake.
Love milkshakes.
And I was like, I've never been more full off in my life off like a small milkshake because they're so dense.
Right. There's a lot to that. So when you got to Philadelphia, then goodness, you took off. I wrote down what you had here. Philadelphia, Denver, Jackson Hole, Hurricane, Utah, bust a little bit, ended up in L.A., but there's got to be a whole lot more to that story than just those bullet points.
Well, okay. we were thinking that we'd try and meet up with the Trans-America.
Yeah, that would be what smart people would do.
Yeah. So we were thinking we'd do the Trans-America bike ride, but when we were in Philadelphia, one of our friends was in a band and they were about to go on tour. And so right when we were going to go off to our sensible, well-trodden path of the Trans-America Trail, we decided
to go to Columbus, Ohio.
Our friend was like, our first gig's in 2 weeks in Columbus, Ohio.
And we were like, we can get there.
We were like, we can do that, you know, before we'd even started to ride.
Yeah.
Just foolishly. And so we went to Columbus, Ohio to meet them. And so we completely changed our trip to go to a gig of theirs.
So the issue was that we started in early May and early April. Mm. And so we went up to Pittsburgh, basically. Mm. We rode the outskirts of Pittsburgh, just following a bunch of bike trails and whatever else seemed sensible on the day. But we hit snow. Basically, and we hadn't packed anything for snow. We didn't think that was going to be part of the equation.
We had like thermals and everything, but I can't tell you, it wasn't snow, a nicer word for it. It was slurry.
Yeah, it was gross. It was just disgusting. High winds and so we were just really unprepared for that.
I was so freezing. In the middle of nowhere, there was this little Salvation Army thrift store. And we rolled up and I looked so cold and disheveled. The women wouldn't let me pay for the gloves, extra gloves and socks that I was. I think they thought, like, this poor girl, I had blue lips, I was shaking.
It might also have been the accent.
Oh, yeah, maybe it was the accent.
It might have been the accent.
Yeah, it could have just been part of the accumulation of good vibes that we get from the accent.
But I'd actually never been that cold before in my life. Like, I lived in England, so, like, I'd been in snow and everything like that, but I was just unprepared, and I was so cold, and that's when I started to... That was one of the days where I was like, oh, I don't want to live in snow in New York.
No, so that's like an interesting, that would be a good time to tell that story. Initially, when we started, so we flew into Philadelphia with the intention of cycling across the country and then flying back and then residing in Brooklyn, New York, where every other Australian ends up. So basically, it was at that point, it was pretty much that day where we were riding into somewhere into West Virginia. Wheeling, I think the name of the place was, and that's when we that was a particularly terrible, sleety, kind of rainy, windy, awful day to be on your bicycle, trying to get, you know, 50 miles or something like that. And I think at the end of that day, we were in a hotel room that night, and we were just like, I don't think that we want to live anywhere where this happens.
So New York was off the list.
Yeah,
I think like everywhere but the Southwest was at that stage.
Yeah,
that
I can imagine
night for sure. Yeah,
yeah. Just
you know, Anna McNuff, she came to the U.S. and biked through all the 50 states, and that was one of the great adventures that she did. But when I asked her about the U.S., her response was, "You have weather there."
Yeah.
And I said, "What?" Yeah. She goes, "No, you have weather."
Yeah.
And everywhere, you know.
But everywhere's different. And
yeah.
It's like, and then you get no rain, but it might mean that you're boiling hot.
Right.
And so the weather is a big thing. The wind in Wyoming, my gosh, like I just couldn't even factor it in. In Australia, it's either pouring or it's hot.
Yeah.
That's about it. And in the UK, it's very temperate. Like
sure.
Everyone thinks that it's freezing there or anything, but it's actually – throughout the year, it only varies like
it's just
in
cold
Celsius,
cold.
Like 10 degrees throughout the year, so it's never that much of a shock. But America just has everything, and that's one of the greatest charms of it as well. You've got every type of weather, you've got every type of landscape. Like it's an amazing place to be, for especially as an Australian, where lots of our landscapes very similar and all of our weather's pretty much similar besides really south.
Mm. Yeah. I remember, I mean, we sort of after Columbus, we started, I mean, you start hitting Indiana and sort of it was around that area where we were in southern Indiana. Mm. And if you rode that far from the coastline of Australia, it would be an awful, awful place to be. You know, it would be just a desolate desert and you wouldn't have anyone around for a long, long way. And here we are in the middle of America in between the two coasts, and it is just so green and so lush. You know, and as an Australian, it's almost impossible to have that much. Like, I mean, in terms of a farming system, you couldn't design a better one than America, you know, like these two huge mountain ranges that go down each coast and funnel all this water bang into the middle of it, you know. Like, it's just such an incredible, another, as a traveler myself, it's a terrible stat and I don't like it, but the rate that Americans have passports, you know, people always point to that one. I can't remember what the exact number is, but it's pretty low.
Sure.
Especially but I mean, you can almost justify it because you have such varied landscapes. I mean, you just kind of have everything in America.
There's a lot.
I mean, you've got every type of environment that you know, really. In fact, I can't think of a type of environment that you don't have. You know, so you can visit everything without ever leaving the country.
Yeah, even like Yosemite. I could spend my whole life in Yosemite and not get bored. You know,
right. Fall is the best time to start thinking snow, and Bent Gate Mountaineering is ready to help you get prepared for your epic winter. Come check out the latest in alpine touring, telemark, NTN, and splitboarding gear. Brands like Black Crows, DPS, Dinafit, G3, Icelantic, K2, Technica Blizzard, Arc'teryx, Mammoth, Salomon, Vole, Never Summer, Jones, and BCA. And you need to be safe out there. BentGate has the latest in avalanche safety gear, from beacons to airbags, and they are ready to help you educate yourself on snow safety. You can also rent skis, boots, split boards, beacons, shovels, and probes at BentGate. What's more, they host free demo ski days at local resorts, so you can try out the latest gear. Stop by BentGate in Golden, Colorado, or go to BentGate.com to check out your new gear, as well as to get updates on all of their events. Well, it is a wonderful place to be, no doubt. But Americans need to travel more. We need to need to get out of the 50 states and see how the rest of the world operates. And that's one of the reasons why we love to do podcasts on adventure travel, because I think there's so much value in it, you know. But hey, for those of you outside of the U.S., come here, and there is a lot to see and do, for sure.
Yeah.
And nice people.
Yeah.
that helps especially if you're Australian.
So you're biking all this way, and you're fairly new to biking. It sounds like, Joe Roxy, you were really new to biking. So,
well, I'd been cycling since I was 21, but not seriously. I started to get more serious about 23, when I would cycle to work every day, and that was the extent of it. And then when I moved to London, I absolutely hated the tube, like hated the tube. So I was like, I'm getting a bike and cycling everywhere. I'm not getting in the tube. Mm-hmm. And then from there, it was like just a very everyday thing for me to use my bike. But then when we started to hatch this plan, I did know that I was pretty far behind Scott's fitness on a bike, and just even coordination. Like, I couldn't take my hands off the handlebars riding when I started. Even when I was on the tour, I actually, first time was in Missouri that I remember I took my hands off the bike and was able to do that while I was riding. So I was very new, so I did need to train. So I was training, I was trying to do at least 20 kilometers a day training. And then
That was probably the last 2 months before we left.
So how did you find biking when you jumped on the bike and you're putting in good distance every day?
I loved it. I was super fit, and it was also lovely because we were living in Melbourne at the time, and Melbourne has such amazing bike paths. You can ride all along the Yarra River, and you can basically not hit a traffic light for hours if you didn't want to. So it's a great cycling city. But then after that, we moved to Sydney for a bit. Right before we left, the last month and a half. And Sydney is basically like
San Francisco
for hills.
I
was like, and Melbourne's super flat, so I had a whole new thing to work out, just trying to get fit for hills. And I'm so glad I did do that, because I don't think I would have been able to do a lot of our touring over big mountain ranges if I hadn't have lived in Sydney. Because I ended up getting a job on the North Shore of Sydney, and the hills there are insane. And I used to ride 13Ks to and from work every day, and it was all hills. And I got to ride across the Harbour Bridge every day, which was absolutely magnificent. If anyone gets a chance to do it, I highly recommend it. It was a challenge for me, but I found it really exciting. And it was, I don't know, I just always feel like there was such freedom in cycling. It wasn't waiting for the tube. It wasn't waiting for or trying to find a park. It wasn't, it literally was just, you could do it whenever you wanted. It was like because I started to cycle so late, I was like, oh my gosh, this is what it felt like when I first got my driver's license, like this freedom, you know. It was this whole new sense of freedom, and I was just loving it.
Well, what about traveling by bike, going the distance? Do you prefer that as a mode for travel now?
Listen, I don't have a big craving to do lots of bike touring where I would be going for a really long time. It took us 85 days to get across America, And if it was like 2 weeks, 3 weeks, I think I could do it. But I don't think I could do that really long span again. I got really bad shoulder pain. My hands were numb for about 3 months after. And I'm sure I just had the wrong size bike and all that, and I could be better next time. But it hurt my body a lot.
Yeah. No, it certainly can. And the racers that we have on the show that do long endurance races, they get lots of those sorts of injuries, even when they're fit perfectly to their bike.
That thing where their head goes floppy.
The neck.
That called? Ooh. That's so petrifying.
Yeah.
Yeah. But mine they was duct tape their helmet like, to their jersey.
I know. Oh. Mental. Not for me, obviously. But I'd do it again, but shorter trips. Or if somebody wanted to ride behind me and carry all my gear, I could go forever. Like with a little camper van with a kitchen and a proper bed in it. I could just go forever then. But camping at the end of cycling for a long day is not fun.
For a long period of time, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't think that this is the thing. When you talk about long bike rides, a lot of people just look at the distance that you did and things like that, you know. But what I feel like is always brushed over is just how mentally taxing it is to end most days having to pitch a tent, you know, and then usually not getting a great night's sleep and all that. So, I mean, this is very much the nature of adventure, but especially when it's sustained over a period of nearly 3 months. Mm. Mind you, we were splitting up the camping with other accommodations, but you know, it's very achievable still. You feel good after you've done it, but at the time you're like, oh man, could do it. Just going inside feels like such a joy. Like you walk into a gas station and you're like, oh, out of the elements, this is so good, you know.
Well, I've never done more than 7 days on a bike, and I thoroughly enjoyed 7, but it's like you said, 85, maybe it gets a little long.
Yeah, but I mean, that's also the balance, that's the battle, and that's why you kind of that's why you end up doing these things, because the achievement that you feel afterwards is the satisfaction of doing it just because you wanted to is for me, that was, I mean, the trip was absolutely worth it the whole way through just for that. I mean, I know there were certain times when I'd find Joe Roxy and she'd be upset and be like, why are we doing this?
And I think that was all of Wyoming. I found Wyoming so difficult.
Yeah.
So difficult.
Was it the wind or the hills?
The wind. The hills I actually liked because it meant you were a bit buffered from the wind.
Yeah.
But the wind was just so intense.
Right.
Yeah. And
the distances.
And wind makes you go a bit mad as well, even when you're not cycling. It's just that kind of, you can ask teachers, like my nieces and nephews go crazy on windy days. Like it's just a strange experience. But it was, I don't know. I found it every day. I had a goal and that was it. And it was really great to just be like, this is my life, just pedal on. But some days I did just go, why am I doing this?
I'm always like, you can't ask that question. As soon as you start asking that question, we'll never make it.
it's all over.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. This is the most futile, like ridiculous thing to do when you really break it down. We're supposed to be doing it for fun and we're not having fun right now. So we've got every reason to quit. But, you know, you just keep going.
But then you could have like 3 bad days and then you just have 1 good meal somewhere unexpected or meet 1 nice person who did something lovely or see 1 thing and it makes you just pumped to do a whole other month, you know? So even though it got hard, the good things were well outweighed it.
Oh, for sure.
Well, let's get some Australian perspective about the United States just for fun.
Go on.
What was surprising about the U.S. when you started your bike? You rode your bike for 85 days. So out of that 85 days, what was the big surprise?
So there's 2 things for me. One thing was I was really, especially being confronted in Virginia by how there were whole towns that were kind of dead, like around the old steel belt,
the Rust Belt area.
The Rust Belt area. It was really stark. And in hindsight, I'm like, oh, that's how Trump happened, you know. But at the time, I was still really amazed by it because, as Scott said, you go anywhere into Australia and there's nothing there. And there was stuff there, and it was like, but it was, there were dead towns. But then you go further in, and I was like, oh my gosh, what are these university towns that are awesome and fun? Almost in every state, you could find a cool university town in the middle of nowhere.
Sure, yeah, we don't have that equivalent. No.
And I was like, oh my gosh, there's this great coffee shop in the middle of Kansas or something like that. But there were like little bastions of stuff. An oasis.
Yeah. Sure.
Every time we found one, and I had no idea that how I understood that there was like university towns, but I didn't get the extent of it.
We've never experienced them really.
No. Yeah.
Because Australia, we just don't have it. All of our universities are concentrated in the major cities, which is probably to our detriment, because we could really revive some of our more regional towns, I think, if we shifted our education industries there. But because they're just lovely places in America whenever you luck onto one.
Oh, any big art college town, always a treat.
Yeah. Nice bars, good people.
Yeah. Lots of fun. It creates a more diverse population, and there's a lot of youth and vitality. And I love university towns. I'm with you. Matter of fact, we just moved to one, so there you go.
I'm jealous then.
Boulder?
No, I lived outside of Boulder in the mountains for over 20 years. But, you know, you were talking about the Wyoming wind.
Yeah.
The wind blew north out of Wyoming, and we were at 8,600 feet. So the wind blew through this mountain valley, and we were the first thing it hit.
Yeah.
Okay.
And so we had winds over 100 miles per hour several times a winter, and constant winds in the wintertime. So we moved farther west and escaped the winds, hopefully. We think we did. And we moved to Gunnison, which is a college town central.
Yeah, up in the hills.
We rode through that, didn't we?
I'm not sure.
I'm pretty sure we did. No?
I think we just drove through it recently. Yeah.
We're always in Denver.
Yeah, we're driving.
Plus, on our bike ride, I've met my best friend I've ever made as an adult, staying in her Airbnb in Denver. And now we're always going to Denver and I fell in love with Denver when I was there. Denver was high on the list of places I wanted to move to.
Well, don't say that too loudly, because everybody's moving here.
Okay, well, that was 2012. We would have been so ahead of the curve. Yeah,
we would have been cool. But I also, in Denver, I just fell in love with everyone I met. Like, and it's such a diverse population. If you go to certain places in the city, like, I had the best Ethiopian meal of my life there. Mm. I just loved it. But I met just through staying at an Airbnb, the best friend I've made as an adult.
And that's probably one of the more surprising things. I mean, it sort of ties into, but just the people, you know, and like the experiences that you have. Like, I didn't really expect to have made long-lasting relationships out of the transient experience of moving every day on my bicycle. You know, it just so happened that we needed a bit of a rest, and we were never in the race across America. You know, it was always going to be a leisurely trip across. So we had 7 days in Denver, and just picking the right Airbnb led us to this, you know, a friendship that we maintain still, you know. In the person Andrea Moore that we're friends with is about to come out to Australia in a couple of months. You know, it's I mean, that's one of the joys of travel, you know, the kind of the little treasures that you find along the way. And a lot of the time those little treasures take the shape of people that you meet. And and I mean, there's a lot of other people that we met along the way that were just our friends for the day, you know.
Sure.
But just, you know, the kindness of strangers type thing.
Are you sure it's not just the accent, Scott?
It absolutely is the accent. It absolutely is the accent. I mean, I remember one of my favorite experiences, Clay Center in Kansas. Mm-hmm. So it was basically, that's kind of, as you're riding across Kansas, you hit eastern Kansas, and that was really surprising for how green it was. We had Kansas is flat and cornfields in our mind, but eastern Kansas was actually quite beautiful.
Oh yeah.
And then so Clay Center's kind of where the last stop on that green belt, if you will. and you start sort of looking at the flat plains. But we're sort of there, and we turn up, and supposedly you can camp in the city park there. It's a very small town, but I read somewhere on the internet that that's allowed. And so I stopped, and I found this school, and I spoke to the school teacher, and I sort of, do you know where the city park is? Cause it's not really well designated, just a patch of grass kind of in the middle of the town. And I'm like, do you know if you're allowed to camp there? And she's sort of like, I don't know. I've never really seen anyone doing it. She's like, I guess you'll be okay if you know, you don't get, if you know, worst that will happen is you get moved on. And I'm like, okay, cool. And we're still kind of new to that part of the country. You know, you're not sort of sure what to expect of people and all that sort of thing. So anyway, we go set up the tent and we're in the city park, and we sort of tuck ourselves in behind some trees.
I can't stress to you enough, though. It's not a park at all. It's like an empty
field, a lot
of land.
So we were basically very worried about whether we should be there or not, and we were very conscious of that. So we sort of tucked ourselves up into bed. It's become night. And then suddenly this car comes roaring up on us. And I'm like, oh, God, these are the old boys that we've heard about. and they literally come and just...
I grabbed... We had pepper spray.
For bears.
For bears and dogs type thing.
Those bears in Kansas, you got to watch out for them.
Yeah, but we grabbed the pepper spray and we're like, we're ready to burst out of the tent. And because this car is like coming just, and it feels like it must only be a couple of feet outside the door, and the lights are still just blazing on us, you know. And we're like, oh my God, like we're in the tent, bolt upright, just ready for action. And then suddenly we hear this voice. She's like, hello, hello, sorry, we baked you some cookies. And we get out of the tent, and it's this school teacher who we really only had like a very quick conversation with. She was obviously minding, you know, a big class of kids, so she had other things on her mind. But she'd come back with her husband, and this was
with
like
two huge bags of fresh baked cookies. Oh, and two loaves of banana bread. I almost cried. It was so sweet.
So did you use the pepper spray?
No, we didn't have to. No. They turned out to be quite nice.
But the cookies, then use the spray.
They did end up staying and talking for so long with their car lights on while we were talking that their car battery went flat.
Yeah, and that's actually one of my favorite quotes from the whole trip. So basically, the guy had to call his mother-in-law, who happened to be about 95 when
she
turned up.
And she was amazing. She told me she lived throughout the
Depression or
something. Oh, yeah. And the Dust Bowl era and everything. Yeah. She was a fascinating woman. But she came out at night with, like, her rollers in her hair. She's 90-something.
Driving a car around.
A jump
at
start.
Night, yeah. But so he said to give a jump start. But the quote was, so basically when he went to start his car again and realized that he'd flattened the battery by leaving the lights on for too long, he just looked at me and he said, well, pulling stunts like this will sure keep a guy humble. So I constantly refer back to that in pretty much every time I fall off my bike now. I tend to think that exact phrase.
But we had so many – that wasn't even an isolated incident. Like, people were so – nice.
Through the Midwest, especially.
Through the Midwest. Sure. And they were like, why? Just their fascination with, like, why are you here?
Yeah, because we really didn't. We weren't on the Trans-American Trail for very much of the trip at all. It was like the bit through Wyoming. That was about it. And that part is so so sparse that you don't really notice that you're on a bicycle touring highway, as it were. But yeah, so because we were just following, I think we followed Highway 40 across Kansas, and people just generally don't see a lot of cycle tourists up there, so there was a lot of interest.
I had, like, beautiful – all the farmers would stop and give me whatever they had on their – like, whatever they'd just pick. Right. I got, like, a whole tray of strawberries one day from this sweet old man. Like, everyone was very lovely.
Again, probably the Australian accent.
Yeah. I feel like we were just very lucky with our experiences. We didn't really have any bad experiences in terms of people.
No.
And we also, like, we stayed, I don't know if you know warm showers.
Oh, that sounds familiar, but help me
out.
So
warm showers is it's kind of like couch surfing, but it's only for touring cyclists. So people... it's a website, obviously, and people put their houses up to say, you can stay at my house for free if you're a touring cyclist. You can either camp in the yard and use my warm shower, hence the name, or lots of people let you just stay in their house. And it's lovely. We stayed with a guy in Jackson Hole for what?
Three nights.
3 nights while we were doing Yellowstone.
And they threw a street party.
They threw a little block party.
Everyone came over. Right.
But it was perfect because it did snow there, didn't it? So yeah. We wouldn't have wanted to be camping.
No, it wouldn't have been nice. But, I mean, we're returning the favour now, and we're Warm Showers hosts down here in Australia. So anytime anyone's riding through Smith's Lake that listens to your podcast, look us up on Warm Showers.
There you go.
Come stay the night.
Yeah. You can stay with Scott and Joe Roxy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And what's the name of the
diamond
python?
Melissa.
Melissa, too. And some chickens.
Yeah, and some chickens.
And the best dog in the world.
Yeah, of course.
Vaughn.
Yeah.
Oh, that's fun.
Want to help support the Adventure Sports Podcast? You can either become a member of our ASP member deal site at members.adventuresportspodcast.com, or you can become a sponsor on Patreon. Just go to patreon.com/adventuresportspodcast. Thanks for listening, guys. The Bearline Plus by 180 Tack is the handiest Bearline utility cord system you can find. This is not your typical Bearline. Our lightweight cord system is designed to be compact, lightweight, frictionless, and very versatile. Don't risk losing your dinner. Hang it the right way. The Bearline Plus is designed to suspend food between two trees up to 40 feet apart and 15 feet above the ground with much less effort than other Bearlines. Not only does the Bearline Plus keep your food away from bears, it is designed to be useful for many other needs, including a motorcycle and ATV recovery system, tie downs, straps, backpack repair, guy lines for tarp or tent, a tow line, block and tackle, and much, much more. Find your Bearline Plus at 180tac.com or retailers near you.
You told us what was surprising about the United States. Do you have a favorite location, having biked through so many different places? I know you ended up in L.A., but besides L.A., we'll get to L.A. Besides L.A., what was one of your favorites?
Oh, the day where we were riding down the Tiawadi Pass. Is that what it's called?
Tiawadi. Yeah, something like that.
And you see
it's on the north side of the Rockies.
See the Tetons for
first time. When you're going into there. Yeah, right.
And as it was such a hard climb up this hill for Tiawadi Pass, I'm pretty sure it's called.
Tiawa Pass.
Going up this hill, it was a mountain. So climbing all day. I can't tell you, it was a really steep ride and it just felt like my legs were lead that day. And as I was cycling up the hill, it was awesome. We'd met people the night before at a restaurant we went to. And then it happened to be that they were doing work at the very top of the hill and they saw me coming. They were like, yeah, get it, go, go, go. As I crested this mountain feeling very proud of myself and I had all these guys going, yeah, do it. We started to go downhill and it was the first time that you caught a glimpse of the Tetons.
Yeah, and we hadn't even known that that was something that was going to happen.
I didn't know that that existed. Yeah. I knew we were going to Yellowstone, but the Tetons didn't come into it for me. And Australia is so flat, so mountains are very exciting. And I can't tell you, I was blown away. Yeah. I just thought it was one of the most beautiful, beautiful things I've ever seen.
Mm.
The Tetons were just incredible. And I've been back since and I feel like I'm still blown away by them.
Yeah, just because they come out of nowhere. They're just like teeth emerging from the ground, you know. And so the guy that we ended up staying with in Jackson Hole, who we met through Warm Showers, he was some kind of medic at Yellowstone or something like that, one of the ones that helicopter in and help people.
Okay.
And he and his father had placed the marker that designates where the summit of the Tetons are. So they'd climbed it a bunch of times. And the last time they'd done it, I think his father was in his mid-70s or something like that.
Wow.
I know. So I got a picture of them sitting on the summit of the Tetons. I mean, Chuck, who we stayed with, must have even been, probably mid-50s himself.
Mm.
But very, very active, very, very intrepid guy too. And well, that's the other nice thing about warm showers is, I mean, the people that are opening their doors to you are usually adventure travelers themselves. So a lot of good stories, that's for sure.
Oh, that's great. That's a lot of fun. Yeah. A lot of fun.
I also really loved, everyone thinks I'm mad when I say this, but I really loved riding across Kansas. It was like a mental struggle for Scott, but for some reason for me, I don't know if it's just I got my legs properly or something, but I listened to Goodbye Yellow Brick Road by Elton John, the whole album, over and over again. And I felt like it was the best thing ever. Like it was just, I found it easy riding, but it was just a different landscape for me. So it might be boring to everyone else, but to me it was quite exotic in a way.
Yeah, it's reminiscent of parts of Australia.
That wasn't on the list to move there, though, I must say.
No. Well, I used to only like places with lots of trees, but I remember when that changed as I was driving across Kansas, one of the dozens and dozens of times that I've done that, and I was like, man, this is lovely. The long rolling hills, the huge swaths of green and amazing skies. You know,
this is it. The weather big forever. Sky. Exactly. Yeah. In Australia, we always say it, we've got big sky. I can't even, the light is very different here, but you always get a big sky.
Because we're so flat.
It's just like you always have space to the sky. Mm. And riding through Kansas, I got the same feeling. And also lots of places in Colorado, that sense of big sky.
Mm. Sure.
Oh, and I loved every single bit of Colorado, pretty much.
Yeah, it's pretty easy to love.
But don't say it too loud because everybody's moving here.
I know.
I think the secret's out, Kurt.
Yeah.
Well, I believe if you like to have four seasons, that Colorado has the best weather on the planet. But
yes,
you have to like four seasons because there are definitely four seasons here.
Yes.
Yeah, and our it's lovely to be an outdoorsy type person, but our big activity is actually surfing. So, and surfing, while liberating in the sense that it takes you traveling to far-flung places where there's no other reason to be there other than the good waves, as demonstrated by the fact that there's no one but surfers there, it's kind of limiting in the sense that if you're going to move to America and still be able to surf, your options are pretty limited. So,
yeah.
Well, not really, actually. I mean, the whole East Coast gets waves too, but you know, that was our big strike against Denver. I think if you guys could just get a wave garden there in Colorado, then you might have a couple more Australian residents.
But in terms of like where we wanted to move to, like a big riding across Kansas, even though I was having a great time, it was one of the realizations where I was like, oh, I really, really need to be next to the ocean or the sea. Like I felt very a bit claustrophobic just not having the ocean next to me, because I've always lived next to the ocean.
Yeah, I think that's a real Australian affliction.
Mm.
Yeah, well, when the ocean gets in your blood, it's hard to shake. That's for sure.
It is for sure. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, the water's a big deal. I remember living in London and cycling just across the Thames, like in the middle of town. And just getting that momentary thing where you're in the middle of the bridge cruising along and just sort of surrounded by water and just sort of suddenly feeling like, oh, why does this feel so good? And then being like, oh, it's because I'm surrounded by water again. This is lovely.
Yeah.
Well, there is one wave in Colorado. It's on the Colorado River, and people surf it when the river's running right.
Yeah.
We actually saw people doing river surfing on our trip. As we were going out of Jackson Hole.
Yeah,
remember
that's
that
right,
day?
Yeah, that's right. We're
it
in
was
the...
a tiny, it was more like a creek than a river.
But the weird part was that we needed to pull over for lunch anyway. It was kind of lunchtime, and we had a little packed lunch going at the time, a couple of sandwiches. And basically we were riding along, and we're in south of Jackson Hole somewhere. So, you know, big gorges and trees and all that sort of stuff. And then suddenly I see these two guys jump out of their cars in wetsuits carrying surfboards. And I was like, hang on, what's going on?
Disconnect.
this doesn't seem right. And so basically, we kind of tailed them surreptitiously and followed them down the gorge and sort of perched high above them up on a little vantage point, ate our lunch, watching them do a little bit of river surfing. I was like, oh yeah, I can see the point to that. That looks pretty fun.
Yeah.
Well, but the wetsuits, I don't know. That takes something out of it.
Well, I mean, you know, it's. I mean, it was middle of summer at that point, I guess. But we'd got snow the night before, so yeah. Oh, I mean,
wow.
I'm still a bit of a pansy, even here where we've got warm water, and the north coast of New South Wales, you start to hit the warm water area. So, but even still, I'm in a wetsuit as often as possible. It's a sense of security.
Scott grew up in Victoria, which is
cold water.
Actually cold water, right. Down South Australia.
So,
he's very used to it. I hate wetsuits. Yeah. I think they're an affliction. I just feel like if you have to wear a wetsuit, it's not as enjoyable. Yeah. But he loves it.
Yeah,
it's good though, because I have had a few nasty spills where my fin hit me or something, and if I wasn't wearing a wetsuit, it would have been pretty bad. But instead, I just get a big bruise.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, that's fun, man. I don't know how to wrap all this up. We're running low on time already, but it seems like we've just started the interview. Yeah. So much fun visiting with you about your adventure across America. I guess I have to ask this: would you recommend it to people? If people wanted to see the U.S., is that a good way to do it?
100%. And there's 100%. Such amazing, I think, don't be like us, don't go off the track. I think if you stayed on the tracks, like the Katy Trail was amazing, which is an old bike trail.
And that's part of the Transamerica.
Yeah, and that's part of the Transamerica. Sure. It would be so much more enjoyable than the way we did it as well. Like, even though I did enjoy what we did, I think if you... anyone could do it on the Transamerica Trail. If I can do it, honestly, any person can do it.
Mm.
Like, I can't stress it enough. Like, everyone's like, that's amazing. I'm like, it's really not. It was hard in places, but honestly, I think anyone could do it.
And the great thing about cycle touring is it's a pretty low barrier to entry. You know, even buying top of the range gear, you know, you're still in for a few thousand dollars. I mean, let's not say that it's, you know, because especially if you're doing something of 3 months length, I do thoroughly recommend buying a bicycle that's fit for purpose and all that sort of stuff. But, you know, once you've outlaid that money, you know, if you're enjoying it, you could, I mean, we met one guy who actually had 17 cats with him he was on his 22nd, consecutive Transamerican. So he was just backwards and forwards.
So wait a minute, he had these cats on his bike?
Two, you know, those things that you take the pets on the plane with, you know, those little plastic cage things. Two of those stacked one on top of each other on the back of his Panera.
It was three of them. It was so high. It was,
crazy. How many cats?
It was 17.
17. But like most cats.
Lots of them were kittens. He picks up stray kittens wherever he goes. He obviously was a bit of a character.
Yeah, he was a character. He's the cat biker, yeah.
Literally, it was on a busy trail where we met that guy, and we kind of just, like, nodded at him, like, kind of thing, just say hey, because we were going places, and he was like, hey, aren't you going to stop to chat? And I was like, I did think, oh, yeah, I want to chat to you. This is going to be amazing.
Yeah. Yeah, but yeah, so that was an interesting one.
So I do think
the other thing is too, I mean, we were newlyweds at the time, and I don't think that we would have the marriage that we do today had we not been through that as well. So, I mean, I'm not recommending it for people who might be on a shaky ground in terms of their relationship because
saw a few couples on tandem bicycles, and we'd call them divorce mobiles, because there would always be someone on the back or the front going, oh, pick up your legs or something like that. But I do think it's good.
It teaches you a lot about each other, and like you go into some really situations where you have to dig deep and kind of rely on each other, and it's a good thing to take in like going forward into the rest of life, because that's probably a lot harder than the majority of our life. So if we can survive that, we can do anything.
I think you learn patience with one another, and and I think Scott learnt to make me stop crying pretty easily as well. Yeah. Just always make sure I've had something to eat and have a beer at the end of the day, and I'll be fine.
Well, it sounds like you had a wonderful time. It really does.
We did. And I mean, and the long and short of the story is we did survive, obviously, cycled into Los Angeles, and there's nothing like cycling into a city with just two bicycles and six panniers full of cycling gear, and thinking, okay, well, this is your new home. Let's go. Wow. Let's go try and rent an apartment.
Get jobs.
yeah.
Do all those things.
One adventure into the next. It was a good time.
So you were 5 years in LA, and how did that turn out for you?
Loved it.
We loved it. Yeah. We spent the first 2 years always completely in LA, but then last 3 years we were living half the year in Mexico or El Salvador, and then half the year in LA.
Yeah.
So we bloody had a ball.
Yeah. And not only that, but LA is such a fun city to live in terms of where you can go for your weekends. You know, you've got so many different climates that you can go visit within
Joshua
3 hours.
Tree, it was a big factor moving to LA after we'd done the bike ride that we'd done, that I knew that you could go to the mountains really quickly. You could go to the desert really quickly. You could go surfing, amazing places.
Big Sur,
California is incredible.
Yeah.
And it had all the little things that I liked about everything, everywhere else I'd been on the trip.
Mm.
But in the end, you're back in Australia.
Yeah, there's no place like home, as they say.
And also, there's no place like we've got little nieces and nephews that we want to be around while they still want to cuddle us.
Yeah, and I mean, it doesn't just because we're home doesn't mean we've stopped traveling. So no. We've got to.
We're going up to the mountains today into the snow.
Yeah, I mean, but also, you know, and we can still take, as Australians do, we don't tend to travel like 2 weeks at a time. So we'll probably still be doing our big long trips all the time.
Yeah.
Well, that's wonderful. And, you know, let's go to the 30,000 foot level. Obviously, the two of you love travel, adventure, big life experiences. What's it like to live an adventure focused lifestyle?
Very pleasant. I think that people think that this happens by luck. But we really made a conscious effort to make our life this. Mm. We don't have kids, which helps. We also don't, we prefer to not spend our money on frivolous things. We like to spend our money to save it. We've got a house, luckily, which means we can rent it out when we go away. Mm. We also have a life. Moving to America made me realize, at least, that I shouldn't have so much stuff so I can be mobile.
Right.
Moving to America with nothing was liberating.
Yeah.
So liberating. And I think not having much stuff is great to just pick up and go whenever you want.
Yeah. But having said that, I mean, that we did arrive with nothing, but when we moved home, we have a third of a container that we had shipped by sea.
Yeah.
So while we've learnt our lessons, we haven't learnt them as thoroughly as hoped just yet. So
well, and you did let us know you can do this with 17 cats.
Yeah, yes, this is true.
Exactly.
You don't need to miss out on. I mean, an adventure focused lifestyle. There's certain things. There's compromises to be made. You know, you have to live your life in an adventure ready mode almost. You know, and we but we, you know, we like going new places and meeting new people and things like that. That's what gives us our energy to keep going.
But it is an addiction. Like, we both have jobs where we can work from home and online, because I could never work in an office again, because I just want to not miss out on anything if I have a great opportunity to do something, you know.
But 10 years in an office for both of us will certainly teach you that.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. No doubt. Yeah. Well, hey, we need to have the two of you back on to talk surfing. And the reason is because, believe it or not, we have done very little with surfing on the Adventure Sports Podcast. And it's not because we've avoided it. On the contrary, we can't catch up with the surfers. They're always out on the water or something. I don't know. But
yeah.
It would be a blast to talk surfing with you.
We'd love to talk surfing. We're
I was also a late bloomer for that too. So was,
yeah.
Another thing anyone can learn if I can do it.
Yeah, if you can come to it in your mid-20s still, you'll never be as good as it's always annoying to see the kids that have picked it up when they're 12. But
oh yeah,
the people who start when they're 12, they tend to lose their stoke by the time that they're kind of early 20s.
Well, I am always stoked.
Yeah, whereas we're still so keen to get in the water every day. So no matter how bad it is.
Yeah. Oh, that's fantastic.
They only want to go out when it's good. So,
well, there are a couple of things we should mention, Scott, before we run out of time here. Bikegang.cc.
Yes, so we documented, we basically posted a travel blog from our Cyclocross America every day, and it's up at bikegang.cc. I always thought the CC could stand for Cycling Club. So if you think of it like that, the bikegang.cc, Bike Gang Cycling Club. So that's still up there on the internet. It's
just a useful resource, I think, for like, you know, camping spots and stuff, as well as just a place for our memories.
Yeah, I mean, it feels more like a personal scrapbook at this stage. It's nice for us to log onto it for ourselves, you know, and flick through every now and then. But we've also done a bunch of other trips that have found their way up there.
And then you already mentioned Andrea Moore and the Wayfaring Band.
Yes.
Just a sound bite. What is the Wayfaring Band? We're going to try to get them on the show so that we can learn more about it. But you guys are on the board of directors. So what's it about?
The Wayfaring Band is a band of travelers, not a rock band, where we take adults experiencing special needs as well as normative people on adventure travels. And we learn life skills from each other, and it's just the best fun in the world.
Yeah, the brilliant thing about it is we take people who are school teachers, a lot of students, a lot of CU students end up coming with us, we'll combine that group with we'll usually have 12 band members, and our band members are usually a lot of folks experiencing Down syndrome or autism spectrum stuff. And we'll just combine it in this great big melting pot, and then we'll go try and do something crazy, like load up 20 people in a bus, and then just, you know, last trip that we did, we went out to Yellowstone, and we've been to Mexico with the band. We
taught some guys how to surf in Mexico when they were living there.
You know, they've just come back from a big trip to Scotland.
Oh, and they went on a sailboat in the Bahamas,
you know. And so this is a Denver-based organization. We've just celebrated our fifth birthday, actually, and we're always looking for people to get interested in us, especially in the Denver area. We do take an artist in residence on every trip too. So you can apply for that program to be taken for free, basically, and bring your artistic view on the world along with us, just to help the group gel. And then but we also take leadership fellows. So anyone who's looking to learn about about learning to navigate the waters of difference. And that's what we're really about, is trying to bring disparate groups together. And people can sign up to come on a Wayfaring Band trip with us, and we'll go somewhere cool and have some great times, and you'll learn a bunch of stuff that you didn't know before.
Yeah.
Wow, that sounds fascinating. It really does, Scott. Yeah. So, like I said, we'll try to get Andrea on the show because we need to find out more about that. I love the concept of, you know, doing adventurous things, doing adventure travel, doing it with others and doing it with a purpose, and then taking people along who, for whatever reason, might be challenged to have those experiences without a group like this to help out. So how cool is that?
That's precisely right. I mean, travel has been a huge thing in my life. It's changed the way that I think, feel, and act in the world. And there's a lot of people that don't get to experience that. And the more people that we can get out there, I think the world will be a better place, because you don't meet too many travelers that don't share the viewpoint that we can all just sort of get along, you know, because we know we can.
I think that's what happens when our world expands a little bit. Right.
Yeah.
We gain that perspective and realize, well, what? Why can't we all get along? You know, we should be able to. If it weren't for the 1% of people on the planet that want to control things and make rules, I think that the rest of us would be just happy. I mean,
That's right. I mean, there are plenty of reasons why we can't all get along, but we're working through them.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, totally.
Well, it's been a blast to visit with the two of you, and thank you for joining us from Australia so that we could hear about your trip across the United States. It's kind of funny that you're in Australia telling us about the U.S. where I am, but it works. It's awesome.
Yeah, good. I'm glad it does. Maybe you can just have a really short trip here and then tell us about Australia.
Yeah.
That would be delightful. That would be delightful.
Yeah.
Really, really good. Cool. Well, thank you very much for your time. We really appreciate it.
Yeah,
it's a pleasure, Kurt. Great talking to you.
Yeah, we absolutely love the podcast. So thanks so much for having us on.
It's our honor to have people like you on to share your life experiences with the rest of us. And so thanks for that. And for all of our listeners out there, man, isn't it exciting to think about what you can do if you just kind of let go of your entanglements and free your mind and take off and try something? Maybe grab a couple of panniers and a bike and go to a foreign country and move there. Experience life on that level. How cool would that be? Until the next show, make sure you do. Get out there. Have some fun.
Coming up on Thursday's episode, Linus Wilson is back to fill us in on his latest sailing adventures. Until then, get out and have some fun.